This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Let's get this reality out of the way early. The family court system is one that exists with a baseline of conflict and dispute. Parents battling over custody are already in one of the worst, most heart-wrenching situations, and their children are often caught in the middle. Then there's the role of the guardian ad litem, a lawyer appointed by the court to represent the best interests of the child. In Connecticut, these very GALs, as they're called, have been the subject of a heated debate between families and the courts. Many parents are angry over what they see as high legal fees and a lack of professional oversight. On the other side, lawyers working within the system are defending their work on behalf of kids. This dispute is at the center of a legislative task force review. Child custody is a divisive issue. Today, Where We Live, we're joined by a panel of guests who represent both sides of this family court debate. We want to know more about what's fueling the contention and what's being done to resolve it, and we want to hear from you. If you have experience in Connecticut's family court system, what was it like? 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at Where We Live. You can always join us online on our website, WNPR.org. Joining us is Peter Shimonek, who's a leader in Connecticut's family court reform movement. Peter, welcome to our show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for welcoming me.
I also want to welcome in Dr. Elizabeth Thayer, who's a partner at Beacon Behavioral Services. She was part of this task force review at the legislature. Doctor, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you very much.
Attorney Jeff Michelson is a family lawyer with 20 years' experience as a guardian ad litem. And, attorney, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. My pleasure.
In just a few minutes, we'll be joined by State Representative Edwin Vargas, and we'll hear from you as well, again, at 860-275-7266. Jeff, I'd like to start with you and ask what exactly, first of all, a guardian ad litem is, what they do.
Well, what a guardian ad litem traditionally does is act as a voice for the children. Do what we can to protect their interest, report to the court to the extent necessary as to what we have discovered about what the conflict might be that would be affecting the children, and most importantly, do what we have to do to get the parents to a point where they can reach agreements about their children and move forward. That's our primary role. That's our role from the time of appointment to the time of conclusion, and that's where we initially focus when we're ultimately either appointed by the court or determined by counsel who are involved in a case that our involvement is necessary.
At what point is your involvement generally necessary? Maybe you can give us walk us through something that would give us a better sense for those of us not involved in the system.
It usually happens one of two ways. Either counsel is involved on behalf of the parties and they get to a point in their discussion about child-related issues where they feel that they cannot resolve their differences. So they will get together and they will discuss between themselves who might be helpful as a guardian, who can come, whose personality and fit is perfect for that particular family, to assist them in reaching some sort of an agreement that counsel has been unable to effectuate between the parties and between themselves. Secondly, if the parties are not represented by counsel or if an issue becomes or comes to the court, a judge can appoint a guardian because of whatever reason the judge feels it is necessary to deal with the dispute that's been presented to the court.
So how much say does a family have or do two sides in a dispute have over who the guardian might be?
Well, if it's done through their respective counsel, they have a lot of say because they can talk with their attorneys. Their attorneys can give them an indication of the individuals that they're discussing, and then they can all make a choice as to who that individual is. When it comes to the court normally selects someone from the list that the court has that they feel would be appropriate to meet the needs of the family.
We're going to take some of your phone calls in a moment at 860-275-7266 as we're taking a look at the family court system. I'm wondering, Dr. Thayer, if you might weigh in a little bit here. Are there other methods of intervention that are available to families that don't involve the appointment of a guardian ad litem or GAL as we're calling them on the program?
Yes, there are, and I'm really glad you asked that because it goes along with the question of when a guardian is appointed. There are other methods of intervention. First of all, people can choose mediation or collaborative divorce in the beginning so that they don't end up in a litigation process. Aside from that, all along the way, early on, there's an early intervention program. It's not housed in every court in Connecticut, but is actually one of the recommendations of the task force, where people would meet in the first 90 days to try to establish a parent plan. They get a volunteer lawyer and a volunteer mental health person for an entire day for free to do that. There's family relations, which is an arm of the court. And so if people are in conflict, they can be sent to family relations to try to help resolve their issues. There are also outside resources. In my practice, private practice, we house the Peace Program, which has been around since 1998. And that's a program designed to help parents resolve issues and stay out of the court process. And we've trained other programs for more lower-income families. The Children's Law Center houses the Families in Transition program, and the Family Service Agencies had a program called Focus on Kids, which was statewide. Unfortunately, the funding wasn't sufficient, and therefore a lot of that program had decreased. But parents have many opportunities along the way, pre-GAL appointment and post-GAL appointment, to resolve their issues so they don't have to end up in the court process.
And from your professional standpoint, does it make the most sense to get this resolved before we get to the court process, before someone is appointed?
There's no doubt about that. Conflict's the highest risk indicator for children of divorce, and we are all very dedicated to making sure that the children are really the focus here and that they can successfully negotiate their parents' divorce, and their parents can successfully negotiate their divorce, and they can remain partners in parenting together post-divorce.
Jeff, how much say in the end does a GAL have in the way the entire situation is resolved in the custody case itself?
The primary focus of a GAL when they're appointed is to do whatever they can in meeting with the parents or bringing on other resources to resolve the issue. No GAL, and as Dr. Thayer has indicated, no one wants the family to perpetuate in the process. We want this concluded as quickly as possible. So we will do that. And the extent to which we have a say in that is we can get the parties together, we can meet with them individually, we can meet with the children, and we can do what we can to convince them that a non-litigated result is far superior for their family than a litigated result. So we do have influence over that. Beyond that, we make to the extent the court wants, if it gets further than that, we make recommendations to the court. The court doesn't necessarily have to accept those recommendations, but that's what our responsibility is, and provide the court information where the court then can make a decision if it gets to that point. But our primary focus is not there. Our primary focus from the beginning is to resolve the differences or to bring on resources that will assist the parties in resolving their differences.
So let me bring in Peter Shimonek before we get to some calls from people who want to join our conversation at 860-275-7266. Peter, what's wrong with the system as it stands right now?
There's a number of things wrong, and this is what's interesting is listening to this from a parent's perspective and also as the perspective of someone that's worked in the legal industry. First, I'm glad that Ms. Thayer mentioned this early intervention program, and this is a prime example of kind of what's wrong with the process. I actually went through the early intervention program very early in my divorce in 2008, and it was one of the success stories. And I believe because it was brought into at the beginning of the process. What's happening in our state as the norm is usually this option is not even presented to parents until the end of the process and when all the money's already gone, because the money's been spent on attorneys, the money's been spent on guardian ad litem, the money has been spent on everybody except for the people that could probably resolve the conflict most effectively at the beginning of a divorce. So that's the first problem.
Just very quickly, and I hate to break your train of thought, but why does that happen? We already heard that maybe there's a lack of funds for programs like this. Is that what it is? There's not money put into these early intervention programs?
I don't believe that's the case. I believe what the real issue is, there is money available at the start of a divorce. You know, parents don't walk into a divorce with no money. Obviously, they've engaged in attorneys. I think the issue is that the options are not presented to them in a manner that they can actually make an intelligent decision. At the very start of a divorce, they're encouraged to engage in conflict. They're encouraged to prolong the case.
By whom?
By their attorneys. Because, again, the attorneys are financially motivated. They have no incentive in a divorce to resolve anything quickly. They absolutely don't. They want to extend it as long as possible and make as much money as possible, just speaking frankly. There is no incentive to finish a divorce within a month. They make no money if that happens. And that's what's happened in our state. The entire system's been co-opted and corrupted by a motivation to make money. And that's the problem that parents are speaking up about now, because it's gotten to the point of financially devastating parents, such as myself.
That motivation to make money, though, in your mind, starts with the attorneys that have been hired by the parents, not necessarily the state-appointed or the court-appointed attorneys that we're talking about, the guardian ad litem, but it starts with the very lawyer that you might hire yourself.
And as an extension of the situation, yes. The other situation that we have is, as we're talking about how guardian ad litem are engaged, there's a couple of things that need to come into play. One is, do they actually need a guardian ad litem? There may not be a need, and more and more often what we're finding is guardians are assigned to cases when there is no actual need for them, just to have a third person who's billing at attorney rates. The second is the role. As we heard Mr. Michelson just describe, what is the role of a guardian ad litem? Nowhere in our state statute does it describe what the role is. And what parents are complaining about is that guardian ad litems in the state have essentially become judges. The judges have outsourced the judicial authority to a guardian ad litem and allows these people who have immunity and are deemed infallible to make life-altering decisions in a case and for a child without meeting with parents and without meeting with children. That's what parents are complaining about. We are hearing over and over again parents that have bills, $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 for a guardian ad litem. The guardian ad litem spent 2 hours meeting with the children, refused to meet with the parents, refused to meet with the family members, is not meeting with the pediatrician, is not meeting with the school system. This is a broken system. It's not a system that's focused on children.
Does that sound right to you?
It does not. It really does not. It's not an indication of anything that I have done in 20 years as a guardian ad litem. I don't know of any attorney who would intentionally foster ill will between the parties and litigation when there was an opportunity to resolve the case. I certainly don't know of any guardian ad litem, and I have never done this, that would do the same thing. Our purpose in becoming involved in these cases, if we're asked to, and we don't request to become involved, we're asked to become involved, whether by the court or by counsel who represent the parties, is to do whatever we can to resolve cases. So what I frequently do, and I know of every guardian who does this, is I immediately meet with the parties. I see what the differences are. I try to persuade them that it is far more advantageous to their family to resolve their differences than not. I enlist the services of other resources. They know exactly what I'm doing as I do that, and they are aware of, you know, exactly what I'm proposing as a means of a non-litigated result.
One of the things that he's talking about, though, is the legal fees involved. The fact is that when a GAL gets involved, they're essentially another attorney that is charging for services. So you've got one on one side, one on the other side, now you have a third person actually billing for services. How is that money billed? Essentially, not only Peter's complaint, but many other complaints that we hear is that this is a very, very expensive system.
It can be expensive if the conflict perpetuates. We try to reduce the conflict, and it actually can, if we are able to do that, reduce the expense because the parties are not going to be involved in protracted litigation. They're instead going to have their issues resolved, and they won't have to worry about the extensive expense of having to go back to court over and over and over again. The control of where the case goes is largely in the hands of the parents. If they can resolve their differences, the case is resolved.
And you it doesn't seem like you believe that.
Well, let's be frank here. The divorce industry is a $50 billion industry in this country, and what's happening right now is parents are organizing online using the power of social media to trade stories. And what we're hearing here is an ideal view of what a guardian ad litem is and how the system works. It is not based in reality. We have an online petition that over 800 parents have signed with absolute horror stories with guardian ad litems. Here's an example. This is my own guardian ad litem bill. $26,000, this guardian ad litem met with my children for less than 2 hours, point blank. This is not unusual. This is not unique. This is what the standard and norm has become in our state. So the story that we're hearing about how wonderful guardian ad litems are and how they reduce cases, it's not true.
Is there a possibility, though, that baked into all this, and again, one of the things we want to talk about is how can this system be better? Perhaps one of the things that's baked into this entire system is a desire by all to have the parties resolve the conflict on their own without the need for this outside help, without the need for $26,000 in legal fees. How do we get to that piece? Because a lot of this, I think, has to be, frankly, Peter, on the parents themselves, doesn't it?
If we have control, and that's the issue. Parents are shut out of this discussion. This is what came to light at the task force hearings. This entire industry, this entire debate, all our legislation has been dictated by the legal industry and the people that profit from the system. No one's approached parents. No one's approached people that are the actual experts in the system, who are us, that have years of experience, and asked us what would we like to see and do better. And this is not a very difficult problem. Other states have addressed this issue. Connecticut's late to the game. We're dead last in the country in resolving this issue. As an example, and just to kind of cross the border, in Canada, the Chief State Justice of Canada came out last summer and said point blank, their family court system is broken beyond the point of repair, which exactly mirrors what's happening in Connecticut when 85% of parents in the court system can't even afford their own attorney. That's how bad the system has become. This is not good for our legal industry.
I'd like you to jump in, but please, Dr. Thayer. Yeah.
Yeah. With all due respect, Peter, the task force listened to an entire day well into the evening of parent testimony and read everything that was given to us and tried to pay very much a lot of attention to and give great respect to parents who are struggling in the system. every day I listen to parents about what it is that they need from the system. I'm not going to disagree with Mr. Shimonek either about early identification, about early options. Absolutely, parents need to hear all that's available to them. They need to hear that the effect of conflict on children and being in a litigation system is seriously detrimental as they go through the process and certainly afterwards, because we have to all understand that most of the parents resolve their issues in the court system without getting to this level. Many do not have GALs and go through the system, and most of them do not get to this level where the costs are so exorbitant.
Do we have a number on that? Do we know how many people get to the GAL system?
I don't have the exact numbers about how many GALs are appointed, but the about 5% or less of parents is what we always talk about.
That's absolutely not true.
Actually end up in not the GAL appointment, Peter, but in the very high conflict.
That's absolutely not true.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have a number?
I do have a number, and it comes from our Chief State Justice. We had a article in the Hartford Courant published by Chief State Justice Rogers where she point-blank admitted that over a two-year period, over 11,500 cases were returned to the court. Now, think about this for a second.
What does return to the court mean?
Return to the court means that the decision that was rendered by the court was somehow ineffective, causing the parties to return. Now, imagine in a civil court if we had disputes with businesses where that volume of cases were returned to the court. That's not reflective of high conflict cases. Other states have high conflict cases. They don't have 85% of parents not being able
but
to afford legal fees.
Are we talking about apples and apples here? Is this the same number that I'm asking about here?
No, we're not talking about apples and apples. I think I don't have the statistics, and I don't know that the court is actually equipped to prepare the statistics as we speak. One of the recommendations of the task force that I read is that they become prepared to do that in the future so that we can monitor how this works. But what I'd like to say in response to Peter is this is not a financially driven process as it is being portrayed. It is simply not. We do not, as guardian ad litem and as attorneys, have this sort of collusive effort that is merely intended to line the pockets of attorneys and GALs at the expense of families. GALs work very hard on a consistent basis to help families. And if you look at ultimately what these statistics will show, most of these cases do not go to litigation, even with an attorney that is appointed as a guardian ad litem, because we are able to work with the parties, make them understand the consequences of going to litigation, and resolve those cases. So it is a very small fraction of the total population that ends up in these extensive litigated high conflict cases. And if you look on the court computer, you can see some of these cases have 300, 400, 500 motions that are filed. These are not motions filed by the guardian ad litem. These are motions that the guardian ultimately in some way, shape, or form might have to deal with.
Can I address that for a second?
And I'm going to have to take a break here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to let our audience know we're talking about the family court system, obviously one that is filled with quite a bit of division. It's one that is the subject of a legislative review. When we come back from our break, we'll talk to State Representative Edwin Vargas, who serves the 6th Assembly District in Hartford. He was part of this look at the family court system. We're also going to take some phone calls from you at 860-275-7266. We will do that when we come back, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about Connecticut's family court system, one that is the subject of a dispute at the legislature, something that is being looked at very closely from both sides. And we're talking today with Peter Shimonek, who's a leader in Connecticut's family court reform movement, Attorney Jeff Michelson, who's a family lawyer with 20 years' experience as a guardian ad litem, and also Dr. Elizabeth Thayer, who's a partner at Beacon Behavioral Services. She served on a task force that the legislature put together to take a look at the family court system. Before we get to some phone calls, and I know a lot of people want to join us, I do want to welcome in State Representative Edwin Vargas, who is a member of that task force as well, taking a look at this. Representative, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me, John, and I want to greet all the other guests you have here on the station today. And I'd just like to say that I came on to this as a representative of the Children's Committee, which is a legislative committee looking out for the welfare of Connecticut's children. And I was appointed by the co-chairs of that committee to this task force that was to take a look at legal disputes regarding the custody of minor children. That was the official name of the task force. And I'm not a member of the Judiciary Committee, which is the committee that usually deals with court matters. But, you know, as a member of the Appropriations Committee, the Children's Committee, and the Commerce Committee, we all respect each other as legislators. We do our work in our own committees, and we try not to interfere with each other, and we trust that our colleagues in their jurisdictions have done their homework and have worked well to make sure that, that whatever area of the state they're working with is,
yes,
is fine. So,
why are you so interested in this issue, sir?
Well, you know, I brought no dog to this fight other than the welfare of children. So I worked on this committee. I was loath to disagree with my colleagues in the Judiciary Committee, but I found that this system was broken. After listening to hours and hours of testimony, reading hundreds and hundreds of emails, letters, receiving phone calls, I realized that we have a problem on our hands with the family court systems. And I'd just like to say there's a couple of things that are really counterintuitive here. I listened to Attorney Jeff Michelson, who was a GAL speak, about the money issue. The fact is, compensation is based on the length of the case. So there is a counter-incentive here to resolve issues quickly. If we compensated GALs for closing the case quickly, then I could see that. But unfortunately, we compensate them for dragging it on. Secondly, why do we have a GAL in the first place? Because our family court judges are delegating this authority to the GALs.
But can I just get back to something that Peter Shimonek said that I think we maybe should spend some time on, and I don't think we have a private divorce attorney present as part of our conversation today. We might get some people calling in. Peter seems to suggest that this entire process starts with private divorce attorneys who want to spend as much time and create as much conflict as possible. I'm not saying that's right, but it seems, Representative, that it may indeed start there. Lawyers bill by the hour. Those lawyers bill by the hour. Before we start going after people appointed by the state or the family courts, maybe we should take a look at the entire legal system. What do you say?
Well, I believe that there may be one advocate of one of the parents, probably the parent with the deeper pockets, does try to talk that parent into having more, being the primary custodian of the child and denying as much visitation rights to the other parents. I believe that happens. I believe there's a very economically driven decision. Sometimes a parent is convinced that if they are the custodial parent, that they will have to pay less alimony or child support to the other parent. So I think those games are played by divorce lawyers, no doubt about it, but I think that's part of the problem, and that may be the beginning of many of the problems, as Peter said. But once you fall into the system, once you're part of those parents that are involved in a dispute over the custody of your child, that's where the problem begins with this whole coterie of people, which includes mental health professionals, which includes the GALs, which includes official schedulers. There's all coterie of people that are attached to these cases that all charge billable hours for very little benefit to the parents that are in the dispute and very little benefit.
Well, one of the things that we read in The Current, and this is taken from the Hartford Current, you can tell me if this is not what you said. It's a quote here. Vargas compared the tight circle of judges, lawyers, and guardians who work in the family courts to North Korea, and suggested they ought to be investigated under federal racketeering statutes. Do you mean to say that the tight-knit group that you're describing of mental health professionals and those involved in the family court system are actually like the dictatorial regime in North Korea?
Well, here's what I found. What I found is that although you may see long lists of mental health professionals, long lists of GALs that have gone through the Quinnipiac training program, you'll find long lists of individuals that are never utilized. It's a small percentage of those people on those lists are the people whose names keep popping up again and again in all these hundreds of cases. So, yes, I believe that it's a group called the AFCC. It's called the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts, which is an association of family courts around the country. Now, normally organizations like this are separate from government function, but that's not the case in Connecticut. In Connecticut, the AFCC members are a group, like a club, and they hire each other, recommend each other. So in the case that you need as a parent.
And this is the thing that we've heard before, that there are maybe some 1,000 or so GALs certified in the state, and there's only 70 or so that work. I'm just seeing Dr. Thayer here. Do you see this as not being credible?
Yeah, I just don't think that any of that is credible. The AFCC is the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts. It's a national organization, and It is a an organization that allows judges and administrators in the court and social workers and psychologists and everyone working in this field to get together. It's a research-oriented organization, presentations, conferences. It's mostly for education. They put out a wonderful journal called the Family Court Review.
But what the representative is saying is essentially that there is this group, and this group hires amongst themselves, and they're the only people who get it. And there's, again, he's saying financial benefit attached. And Attorney Michelson, you disagree with that?
I do. I've never been hired. I've never been involved in a case as a result of my membership with the AFCC.
What's that? Your partner has.
No one has been hired, to my knowledge, as a result of their membership in the AFCC. The AFCC is a group that preaches collaborative resolution to divorces in custody. They issue substantial journals. There are seminars and symposiums all around the country which always focus on conciliatory ways of resolving cases. It's a great organization, and we learn from that. We all learn from that.
This is an issue of independence, and what we talk about here is, and one thing that I'd like to bring forward is you raised the issue of divorce attorneys are the root cause or where we should start.
I was suggesting that from something that you said, that perhaps we might consider that as part of the problem.
Right, and one thing that's not considered is we have a scenario here where the guardian ad litem in the state are almost exclusively divorce attorneys. So you have a scenario where in a case you'll have plaintiff's counsel, defense counsel, and a guardian ad litem, and they play round robin. In the next courthouse, you be guardian ad litem on this case, and I'll be the divorce attorney in this case. And that's how the system works.
Wouldn't you want somebody who has experience in that world actually taking on a role so very important? I mean, I don't think that you'd want somebody who, I don't know, takes a look at some other part of the law necessarily representing children in the court.
Well, let's go down this path. What exactly is a guardian ad litem? A guardian ad litem is not a profession. It's not a trade. It's not a vocation. No one goes to college to become a guardian ad litem. No one goes to law school to become a guardian ad litem.
It doesn't sound like anyone would go to law school in order to make the fantastic salaries that you would be as a GAL. It seems – I guess your point is – I get what you're saying, Peter, but –
I'm just
questioning the premise of this. Are you suggesting that we have a professional class of GALs who sign up to do that and
What I'm actually saying is the opposite. Why do other states do this so much better than we do? Because
yes.
The guardian ad litems are not attorneys. The guardian ad litems are mental health professionals, people from all walks of life. As an example, in the state of Florida, guardian ad litems are almost exclusively unpaid parent volunteers that are monitored by the state. They don't have the same issues we have here in the state of Connecticut. They don't have 85% of parents pro se. And yes, they do have high conflict cases, just like we do here in Connecticut. This high conflict label is an excuse by the divorce industry to excuse what's going on.
Here's what we want to do. Let's get to some phone calls. Hector's in Glastonbury. Hi, Hector. Go ahead.
Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Yes.
Okay, first I want to point out that Dr. Thayer and Attorney Michelson are colleagues of my GAL, so I risk retaliation by just speaking. Second, as to the issue about the appointment of the GAL, I never had a say in it. My attorney pretty much said, you're doing this, end of story. He didn't advise me of my rights. I tried mediation. With respect to mediation, I did try. I wasn't asking for anything that Connecticut already doesn't recognize and involve parents such as myself. And last point I'd like to make, the GALs in this state are not supervised at all. I lost my kids in August of 2013 on an affidavit that the GAL filed, and it has perjury in it. The state's attorney is aware of that perjury. I reached out to the GAL to see if we can address that, and it still hasn't been addressed. So as to these comments that we're bitter people, that's a mistake. The GALs are totally unsupervised in this state, and it's important that we start supervising them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your phone call, Hector. And I will just say I'm not sure that anybody on our program has said that anybody is bitter people. I just want to make sure that our listeners understand that. Let's go to Cheryl, who's calling from New Haven. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
I'm a concerned parent support group as well.
What's that now?
I am U.S. Concerned Parents Support Group as well. We court watch and we advocate for parents in the courts, family courts, juvenile courts.
Okay.
I just want to say that the system is not built to keep the family together or preserve your family, is why the family courts should be overturned and returned to the churches with mediation with workers rather than all this money-making business that's going on.
Well, Sheriff, first of all, thank you very much. Edwin Vargas, can I just ask you a question? Beyond what we think of this system as it is currently constituted, where the money flows, et cetera, what Cheryl's bringing up is she seems to think it's a system that's not built to keep the family together. How would you revise this system to make for better outcomes for people, given what you've heard so far?
Well, I believe that there's many people in this country that don't want to help parents come to a fair agreement over the custody of their children. During the hearings of the task force, I mentioned, you know, family counseling, counselors, chaplains from the military who may want to retire and come back to civilian life to this kind of work. Even the family center, the family relations centers could be expanded so that program could address some of these issues. I heard some good experiences people have with family relations, some not so good, but some better than others. But at least the costs were not these outrageous costs. And we're hearing about cases of $20,000, $30,000, but out in Greenwich County, we had cases of well over $100,000. And, you know, the interesting thing is when a person becomes a GAL, we agree that they're no longer functioning as an attorney. They're functioning as a guardian ad litem. Why do they have to charge the same rate that they charge their corporate clients as an attorney when they're dealing with a family? There's a lot of issues here, and I think Peter hit the nail right on the head. We have no system of supervision, of evaluation. We have no code of conduct, no code of ethics for GALs. And even though nothing is defined, they don't have to break down their bills. They don't have to give you any reason of why they're charging what they're charging you. And they have the best collection officer of all, the judge, who can come after you to make sure you pay those bills to that GAL. And here's my question. If you're the G, why grant people who have no code of standards, no code of ethics, no supervision, and frankly, very little training, why would you give them absolute immunity from perjury, fraud, or any crime?
Well, right? let me ask Attorney Michelson to deal with that. But first of all, I'll say it doesn't sound to me like most of the people we're talking about have very little training, although I clearly don't know that much about the system, to this idea of code of conduct, no oversight. Could you just respond to what Representative Vargas had to say?
Well, I think there's certainly an informal code of conduct and oversight because the court is available if either of the litigants feels that there is irresponsibility on behalf of the guardian.
I'll just stop you quickly and say I'm quite sure that most parents would say an informal code of conduct isn't a code of conduct.
Well, we also have another problem.
Well, very quickly, but I'm just interrupting just to say that an informal code of conduct isn't actually something that you can be held responsible for. But please continue.
But yeah. We have our ethical responsibilities as well. I mean, we still have a responsibility to the children and to the families. And the unfortunate part about all of this or some of this discussion, which is what I disagree with, is this premise that guardians or attorneys are in this only for money and they have no interest in families and they have no interest in children. And if they're appointed in a case where there happens to be money, they have no motivation whatsoever to bring the case to a close. I categorically disagree with that. Our motivation, our responsibility, ethical, moral, and otherwise, is to resolve cases as quickly as possible, no matter how much money is involved in the case. And if you ultimately look at how many people actually go through the system versus in a non-litigated way versus don't go through the system in a non-litigated way, you will find most people will try to resolve their cases as quickly as possible and without court intervention. They don't want to go through it. They don't want to revisit it. They want to move on with their lives. You look at the other cases where there's substantial litigation, it is not driven by the guardians. It is driven by whatever dispute that the parties have that they just simply cannot compromise.
Is there a different way, though, to make the money work if indeed it's not about trying to get as much money out of the both sides as possible? Is there a different way to make the money flow so that there's not so much at stake?
I agree with one of the recommendations of the task force, and I wasn't a member of, but I've reviewed them, is to essentially establish the fee for the guardian ad litem at the start of the case, establish the role of the guardian ad litem, define what his or her responsibilities will be throughout the case. And if those responsibilities somehow extend beyond whatever the fee is that has been agreed upon, then the court can readdress the issue at that point in time. That's a perfectly reasonable suggestion as articulated by the task force. That's one way of accomplishing it.
Please go ahead.
The difficulty for me with these conversations is the same difficulty I had when I was on the task force, which is that we've got to stop talking about collusion. We have to start talking about collaboration. Nobody's in disagreement here. The system needs some change. The task force came up with numerous recommendations, which we can group if we want to talk about them in a little more detail. The minority report was also attached. But there are some very sound recommendations made. So we
if
need
you
to
can
make,
give us some. Yeah, no, I
sure,
would appreciate that.
We need
that.
To make constructive change, some smart, realistic kind of change. So some of that change does have to do with oversight of guardians. So some of that change does have to do with report back to court for guardians. Some of that change does have to do with establishing funds for early intervention, early identification, giving parents an opportunity to work with people so they don't get into the system. Some of the recommendations had to do with expediting cases and more efficiency on cases, had to do with if people have not seen their kids for a length of time, we need to move those cases into before a judge. And there may need to be some consequences if parents are found at fault for restraining children from seeing another parent and there's no real cause. There's so many recommendations, aside from data collection and things like that. We talked about establishing a system where these cases can, if there's grievances, they can be brought much more expeditiously. There are many really valuable recommendations. I don't want them to get lost in this process, in this rhetoric.
Do some of those recommendations make sense to you, Peter?
They do, absolutely, and I'll put one on the table immediately for a response. If you basically look at what a guardian ad litem is supposed to do in the state, they're supposed to evaluate a child's situation according to 16 criteria. What's their current educational situation, social background, ethnic background, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a question I raised during the task force. This set of 16 criteria is the same from child to child to child. It doesn't matter if it's a child of a millionaire, a child of someone in the middle class, a child of someone on welfare. So here's a benchmark question. This being the case, why do guardian ad litems bill by the hour? Why aren't they assigned on a flat rate? For a set $2,500 fee, I'll evaluate the child according to this criteria, and here's my report submitted to the judge, period. I think every parent on the planet would agree with that. Instead, what we're finding is outrageous bills. I mean, I have a spreadsheet before me out of 30 business
people. What the attorney just said is, what if the rule is you set the terms beforehand? Here's what the guardian does. Here's what the fee is going to be. You agree? You agree? Let's go.
And what you just described is exactly what the state of Maine passed last summer. In addition to, now in the state of Maine, guardian ad litems need to report publicly how much they're receiving from the parents and how much time they're spending with the children publicly. That's a fantastic change because now there's visibility into what the guardian ad litem is doing.
So a change like that, does that make sense to you in Maine, the way they do it?
I don't know specifically how they do it in Maine, and if, as represented, I have no issue with there being, as I said, established at the beginning of the case parameters for which a guardian is going to be paid and how he's going to be paid and how ultimately over time we will deal with however that should be adjusted.
So we're getting to at least some resolution here, which is nice. Let's go to Monica in Hartford. Go ahead, Monica.
Hi. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, go ahead.
So my situation is a little bit unique, and I was present at the task force on January 9th, speaking of my experiences. My GAL was appointed to my case, and this gentleman was appointed at a state rate due to my ex's unemployment at the time. This GAL was earning $50 per hour to manage our case with my autistic 7-year-old. He took 4 weeks to write up a 20-page report, which was very clearly written. He checked references. He implemented a conflict management plan with my ex and I. He recommended shared equal custody. I have not had equal custody of my 7-year-old autistic son in almost 4 years. I have been groveling with the court system to see my son 50% of the time. This GAL recommended equal custody, equal access. It was Holly Avery Redstone out of Rockville who went against this report, and I believe she did it to further bring on the litigation, which we are expecting a third custody battle this summer. So we have a GAL that's earning $50 per hour, has no incentive to get rich off my case, and he implemented a great plan for my family.
Mm-hmm.
The judge went against this and ordered us to go to therapy. She took more time away from me. And I believe the judges are in on this conflict, you know, encouraging the conflict.
Well, first of all, Monica, thank you very much for sharing your story. It sounds as though you had a good experience with your GAL. What out of the recommendations that so far we've had from the task force, doctor, I mean, what do we know about the role of judges in all this?
I think judges have to deal with a lot of information that comes into them over a very short period of time, and That's why GALs and all of us don't necessarily want to bring cases before a judge, because it's a very difficult position to be in. One of the things I wanted to respond to that Monica brought up is there are GAL appointments available for parents who have low income, both through the state and also through the Children's Law Center. And they have to qualify financially at the Children's Law Center to do that, but they then have a GAL who's appointed. So I'm pleased that she had a good experience. GALs make those recommendations to the judges, and judges review the material and have to make very difficult decisions with little information.
We're talking about potential reform to Connecticut's family court system. You just heard from Dr. Elizabeth Thayer, who's a partner at Beacon Behavioral Services. She was part of a task force that the legislature held to take a look at reform. Attorney Jeff Michelson is here, who's been a guardian ad litem for some 20 years. Peter Shimonick is a leader in Connecticut's family court reform movement. And joining us by phone today is State Representative Edwin Vargas, who is also a member of this task force. We're going to come back, take some more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, key deadlines are coming up for some proposed legislation at the state capitol. Our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, will talk about what bills may or may not make it out of committee. We'll also discuss the role of money in this year's statewide elections. And Common Core remains in the national headlines, with Indiana actually dropping the standards. You can join the conversation coming up in The Wheelhouse on the next Where We Live. Today we're talking about the family court system in Connecticut. We're taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. A lot of people want to join us, including Barbara in Hartford. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning.
Hi. What's up?
Good morning, John. I'm calling. I'm a practicing divorce attorney, and I've been practicing for over 25 years. And I just want to challenge the concept that we have an incentive to perpetuate the conflict or to litigate cases, because for me and for most of my colleagues, I tell clients as soon as they come into my office that the greatest service I can give them is to keep them out of court. And I encourage them to use mediation or collaborative divorce to try to resolve their matters. And the one thing I have learned over the years is that it takes both parties to want to resolve their conflict in a peaceable manner, in a way that serves the interests of their families. It only takes one to make the matter very contentious and therefore very expensive. So I just want to take issue with that. I also would like to say that, you know, over 97% of cases, and I think there's about 17,000 cases that are filed in Connecticut yearly, the vast majority of cases do settle outside of court. They do settle with parents making decisions for children, not courts and not GALs. So I think that's a very important point. And that's not to say that there's not improvements that could be made to the system, including early intervention, all the things that Dr. Thayer and Attorney Michelson have mentioned, and some of the recommendations of the task force. But I think that gets lost in just the individual attacks and complaints.
Well, Barbara, thank you very much for your phone call. I want to hear from a few more voices here. Dan's in Trumbull. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What's up?
You know, out of respect for the comments that Barbara just made, certainly I think she does address one important point, which is I don't think that there's any parents who are saying that all attorneys and all judges and all GARs are problematic. It's been my experience that there are good ones. Sadly, none of the good ones seem to have been involved in my six-year ordeal. The thing that I would like to highlight quite quickly is, you know, Representative Ed Vargas made some very, I think, insightful comments. And people like to talk about this group of advocate parents and say, well, they're just angry litigants. But, you know, Representative Vargas had no involvement in this, and he's got a long, reputable career as a legislator and also as an educator. And certainly his strong comments should speak volumes to what's going on here. The thing that I'd like to highlight is the fact that when there are issues with, legitimate issues brought up with respect to attorney misconduct or GAL misconduct or judicial misconduct, there are two agencies of the state or departments, one's called the Judicial Review Council, that's supposed to evaluate independently complaints brought against judges.
Yes.
One's called the Statewide Grievance Committee. Both of those organizations are significantly flawed in that they are staffed with insiders who essentially will whitewash the record and dispose of any complaints that are legitimately brought forth, and except in only extremely rare circumstances is there ever any true recourse for somebody. And sadly, the Connecticut Supreme Court in its decision two years ago, with a case called Sims versus Seaman et al., where they essentially upheld absolute immunity for attorneys, even in instances where there are findings of fraud involved.
And Dan, I apologize. I don't want to get too much into the weeds on some of the stuff, but I very much appreciate your thoughts on this matter. I got to get to one more phone call before we go because we're running low on time here. Jesse's in Glastonbury. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what's up?
So I'm actually, like your guest, Peter, I'm also an attorney myself. I just recently went through what I'm sure any of them would constitute a high-conflict divorce. And actually, Jeff was the guardian on my case. And I think that you really have hit the nail on the head when you address the code of conduct. Because what Jeff is discussing and the other guest, and actually the other attorney who just called in, they're talking about the way that they operate within the system. Jeff was a fantastic guardian. I have every reason to believe that Jeff was doing absolutely everything that he should be doing. But the problem is that's not a system when there's no recourse for when there's a guardian who doesn't. Because while Jeff operates fantastically, I thought he was fantastic, the bottom line is, what does a parent do when there is a guardian who isn't operating fantastically?
Well, and Jesse, thank you for the question. So what does happen? Let's get that out there. And obviously he thinks that you were fantastic in your job, Jeff. But what happens if somebody doesn't think that Jeff's doing a great job?
Well, then they have the recourse to go to the court and indicate whatever the problem is. It's hard to predict what each problem may be or what each complaint may be. And the court then can assess whether or not those complaints are legitimate or illegitimate. One of the recommendations of the task force is the opportunity of litigants to get before the court, whether the judge handling the case or another judge. There's also a single judge theory that was espoused, where you can register those complaints and a determination can be made whether or not the guardian should be removed.
Representative Vargas, before I let you go, and we're very low on time, I asked you about this before and we kind of skirted around the question. The reason I asked you about your comments about North Korea and collusion and all this is it feels like language like that in a high conflict situation leads to a little bit of hyperbole. It leads to the sort of name calling that probably isn't all that useful. Are you exactly right in saying that this is like North Korea?
Well, maybe it's not as bad as North Korea, but I'll tell you this. There's been two articles written in the Washington Times that have been nominated for Pulitzer Prizes by reporter Ann Stevenson that have shown that multiple AFCC chapters around the country have been shut down by the IRS for violations of laws and regulations. You have a small group of people working as vendors for the state of Connecticut, some of them being paid for the job they're already being paid for by the state taxpayers as their regular job. So I have to look at this and say, how were they able to act as vendors? I'm not sure if they're a business, if they're a nonprofit. They have issues with the Connecticut Secretary of State because they weren't registered for years, and millions of dollars have disappeared from that organization. So, yes, I think we have a problem of inside baseball here.
Well, and Representative Vargas, and I apologize, just because we're running low on time, I want to give everyone a last say here, and thank you very much for your time. He served on this task force. You want to jump in quickly, Doctor?
Sure. I categorically disagree with what Representative Vargas just said. But look, these parents come in at the time of a very vulnerable time in their lives. They're extremely vulnerable. They're extremely shamed. They're extremely angry. They're extremely frightened. It's really our job to work with them so that this conflict doesn't get to this level. When people feel like that, they tend to want to blame other people. We need to make this a constructive dialogue.
And can we, and very quickly, Peter, can we make this a constructive dialogue? Do you think that we can come away from a conversation like this with some recommendations that might make sense?
I absolutely do, but I think the critical part is that parents, taxpayers, and voters need to be part of the conversation. It can't be co-opted by the legal industry.
Peter Shimonic, Attorney Jeff Michelson, Dr. Elizabeth Thayer, thank you all very much for joining us. There are a lot of people who wanted to join us that couldn't get on today. Many people calling. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WNPR.org. Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. We'll be back in the wheelhouse tomorrow here on Where We Live.